Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
Hi, I'm Arno from Hong Kong, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
And welcome to the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph and with Eurosport. I am Catherine Whittaker. I'm talking to you live, well, not live. I mean, as I'm saying it, it's live, but as you're listening to it, it is not. But crucially, I am in the Putney Exchange Shopping Centre, and I'm joined by David Law.
Spiritual home, Putney Exchange Centre. It's been a while. We're back.
Well, it's not been a while for me. It's been a while for the Tennis Podcast.
Which is all that matters, really.
Yes, we are installed in a coffee shop, which we won't name because they don't give us free coffee.
No, not yet anyway.
But they do give us their warm hospitality.
Do we name them
which,
in the hope
fair,
that they
give
will
to
start,
everybody or... that gives them, that buys coffee from them.
Yes.
But it's good to be back.
Very good.
I mean, mostly because it's so handy for me.
Yeah.
David's travelled all the way from Solihull.
I've basically gone the breadth of the country.
To be here. But we're very glad that we are here, and we're very glad to be bringing you this new podcast because there is a lot to talk about. Somehow it sort of ended up, I mean, I know it was always going to be with an ATP Masters 1000, but with Sharapova winning in Tianjin, suddenly there is lots to talk about it. And with both races hotting up, well, one race is complete, the other race is very much hotting up for Singapore and London. And as I was putting the finessing touches to our agenda today, David, I really hovered over the order, over what to lead with. I had a real sort of BBC News-esque news dilemma. And yesterday on 5 Live, Russell Fuller, our colleague from 5 Live, he led with Maria Sharapova over Federer winning Shanghai. And I'm loath to disagree with the BBC, so that's where we'll start.
Well, I'm
as well.
Kind of also the BBC. Shall I argue with it? I'll tell you what we'll do very quickly is just as a Tennis Podcast lead, we'll go with thank you very much to Arno for introducing the podcast at the very start of this. Mr. Kickstarter backer himself, one of the many that have got behind us and enabled this podcast to happen in 2017.
Where does he come in the race for best podcast intro, which
introduced
last week?
I'm sure he'll understand that whilst he is in the playoff positions, he's up there. He is a little behind Ella Ehrlich of last week, who was just amazing.
It's not really a competition, is it?
No.
I mean, it's...
Unless you've got any pets you want to put on
the
air.
It's a fix. Oh, hang on a second.
Well...
I know this is radio, but for the purposes of the tape, my eyes just lit up. Now, as did the eyes of Maria Sharapova yesterday, because she clinched her 36th career title, but crucially her first title since returning from her ban, which we all know about. It clearly meant a lot to her. She beat the Belarusian teenager Arina Sabalenka in the final. She fought back from 1-4 down in the first set, 1-5 down in the second set. The final took a little over 2 hours. She's risen up 29 places in the rankings just this week and is now at number 57. I should say, of course, she was a wild card entry to the tournament. Now, she was, you know, ranking aside, head and shoulders the best player in that tour. You know, looking at it on paper, she ought to have won it, taking any fitness considerations out of the equation. But she really had to fight in that final, and she did do it, and there's really no doubting her tenacity.
Or her level, really. And I mean, and pleasingly, her fitness as well, because she's got through that event, although I didn't see all the matches, she's got through them all, she's won them all. Some of them were hard fought, actually, as well. I think the final, there was a 10-8 tiebreak in it, something like that. So it bodes well for her future prospects. I mean, winning a tournament like that is kind of what I would rather have seen her trying to do 6 months ago, to be honest. That's old news now. It has happened. I just think that this... I think this is better all round. I think this is better for her. Win a lower-level tournament. This was an international series tournament. As you say, you look down the list of players. A lot of players in there I didn't know too much about, to be honest, in that tournament in Tianjin. She won the tournament. She went there and she did the business. We talked sketchily about what sort of prospect she might have for the future. I think she is... fitness permitting, going to be a serious contender next year. I really do. Her level all the way through this comeback. Okay, she's had physical breakdowns, but actually I think her level is arguably higher than when she went away.
I could see her winning the Australian Open. I could. I say that because I'm starting to think, as much as the Australian Open did their launch this week, and Craig Daly, bless him, very optimistically said, I've spoken to all the players and they're all going to be there. It's going to be
Serena,
you know, the greatest.
Andy.
And I admire his optimism. And he certainly wasn't lying at all, but that was the best possible. What he was saying is nobody has actively said that they're not going to be there.
Yes.
So, you know, on the information we have at the moment, we've no reason not to think that all the best players are not going to be there. I mean, Bjorn Borg hasn't confirmed that he's not going to play either, so who knows? But I just looking at things, we've had a couple of Serena Williams posted the first picture of her daughter, Olympia, on Instagram this week. She's adorable, obviously. I'm just starting to think, and I could be way off base here, but I spoke to a personal trainer this morning, and okay, this is, I know that Serena Williams is a physical marvel, you know, not like other human beings. I get that, but we haven't seen any pictures of her in training or anything in the gym.
A couple of people have told me that they have seen pictures
have they?
Of her.
I've not seen any publicly.
Incredibly trim.
She definitely does. I mean, going on the pictures of her in the late stages of pregnancy, I'm not suggesting she's not trim and, you know, still a formidable athlete. I think it would take, you know, probably about 8 consecutive pregnancies for her to not look like a formidable athlete. But realistically, she's not rocking up in Australia unless she thinks she can win it. And I think in order for that to be the case for her mentally, she needs to be in training now. And I don't know if she is. I don't know if she is. The personal trainer that I spoke to, like, said even somebody of the absolute highest echelon, and obviously the woman I spoke to has never worked with anybody of an echelon of the like of Serena Williams. Not many have, but they would need to be in training now.
Yes, I can imagine that.
She might be doing it privately, but I'm not sure that she is. And with that being the case... I mean, Sharapova now, this hasn't changed this week, it's just come out this week. She has a winning head-to-head record against every single active player other than Serena.
Really? I didn't know that. That's very interesting. And actually, when you put her up head-to-head against most players since she's come back, she's certainly not looked overwhelmed, apart from that drubbing she took from Simona Halep the other week. And I think that was Halep at her very best, and I think Sharapova was some way short of her best that day. Her game certainly stands up at this age that she's at. But the big question is, can she physically keep it going? She's had so many issues, that forearm, shoulder, all the things she's had. She had the one where she pulled out, I think, in Rome, leg problem. You know, she has been breaking down, and let's not forget, again, 2 years ago we thought she was retiring. So that says a lot about how much frustration she has had to endure physically. Serena, in terms of can she come back and be competitive, can she come back and win the Australian Open?
Well, she can.
I think if she's anywhere close, she can, because don't forget, her level is so far and above, better than everybody else's, that there's quite a buffer there that she can fall back on.
But equally, she's not taking any risk. She's not risking rocking up in Australia and losing to Maria Sharapova. There is no way she's risking that.
Yeah, but she can't.
She's not
know
leaving that,
that
down. I think if she's at her best, she does know. She, in her mind, she knows. I've got her number. If I'm at my best, I've got Maria Sharapova's number.
Do you not think 90% Serena would just think, you know what, I still think I can beat her?
Probably, but I'm not sure she'd want to leave any percentage to chance.
But where else would she come back? I think she's probably going for it at this stage.
I'd love her to be going for it. And maybe that's all part of the plan, that she is in the gym 15 hours a day.
I haven't even got an event to sell, and I'm of the Craig Tiley view. I'm looking at it and I'm thinking, I tell you what, the Australian Open is going to be amazing, isn't it? We've got Sharapova back. You've got Serena Williams on her return. You've got all these players who've made their breakthrough and become world number one. Then look at the men's game. You've got Djokovic. You've got Murray coming back. Stan Wawrinka.
Even if some of them aren't there, we will talk about this plenty when the time comes, but it is going to be one of the all-time extraordinary Grand Slams, or certainly ought to be on paper. But anyway, look, Serena aside, she's a contender for Australia. I don't see her getting the better of Serena. I don't see her overturning that head-to-head, that one-sided head, in the way that Federer has. He's not overturned it in the numbers, but I mean, he's turned it around.
She doesn't have that ability.
She's not going to do that. One thing I've done this week, David, I must admit reluctantly, is I've ordered Maria Sharapova's autobiography. I don't want to read it, in that there are other books on my shelf, but I feel like it is my duty as a tennis journalist to have read that.
I agree. We had this conversation a while back.
Yeah. And in fact, one of the things, I was chatting to a few other people in the tennis world who have read it, and they were telling me how Serena focused it is, how much there is about Serena in there. And by contrast, Serena's book from a few years ago didn't even mention Maria Sharapova.
Who?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, anyway.
Which I find very interesting. But anyway, I haven't read it. I will read it.
Yeah, we'll get the proper review from Catherine when she's bothered to read it.
Are you saying you've read it?
No.
Right, okay.
I've been a bit busy.
I'll lend it to you.
Okay.
It might take me a while to wade my way through it, just as a warning.
Yeah, okay. just as I was going to say, though, incidentally, could Maria Sharapova come back better than before? I said that I think she's playing marginally better now than when she actually had to stop for a while, and that's basically because she was so in and out of injury all the time. But if I were to go back a year before that, the Australian Open of 2015, when she played Serena Williams, and I thought she had a real chance, if ever she was going to have a chance, because she was playing so well, and she still lost handily in straight sets, and she played well, but she just got knocked into the next year, basically, by Serena Williams. So I don't see Maria Sharapova coming back a better player than she's ever been, put it that way.
No, nor do I.
And Roger Federer is a better player, arguably, than he's ever been.
And we'll come on to that, David, all in good time. In fact, we'll come on to it in just a few moments. But before that, I must just quickly give very rightful mentions to the other WTA titleists from this week. Anastasia Pavlyuchenkova beat Daria Gavrilova to win her third title of the year in Hong Kong.
So
that's
best
pretty good going
of her career. Pavlyuchenkova, to me, she's an underachiever overall. If you look at what she did as a junior and you look at her trajectory over 7 or 8 years of her career, she's been in the 20s and 30s her whole career. This time she's going to finish at her career high ranking. It'll be only just outside those top 10 places. It's been a really good year for her.
Yeah, I'd agree with all of that. And we also have Barbora Strizova winning the title in Linz, beating Magdalena Rybakova in the final.
Yes, I didn't get a chance to see that match, and I can imagine there were some spectacular rallies between two players who love to dink it about and get to the net and do all the sort of things that I'm going to do when I play you and in our rematch.
Slice and dice is what he calls it.
I should go and get the recording of that match just to tune up. Really,
I'm sure it's available on WTA Stream.
I'm sure.
Now is the time, David, that you can unleash all of your thoughts about Shanghai, and in particular, there's plenty of other talking points aside from the Federer Nadal final, but of course, we have to talk about Federer winning it, him beating Nadal in that final, which maybe controversially, I'm going to say it was a slightly disappointing final.
It was
an extraordinary performance from Roger Federer. And there is a question mark, perhaps more than a question mark, over Nadal's knee, which we'll talk about in a moment. But as a final, it was a bit of a letdown.
It was a letdown because I think coming into it, Nadal had won 16 matches in a row. He'd won the US Open, he'd won Beijing, he'd reached the final, he'd squeezed past Dimitrov, he'd won a really good match against Marin Cilic in the semi-finals. And I thought, right, well, actually Federer, on his way to the final, didn't look as convincing as earlier this year. And interestingly, putting it to the vote, pre-final, there were 700 votes and 65% or so were thinking that Nadal would win that final. And that's on the back of, what was it, three wins in a row this year from Federer over Nadal, and two of them really comfortable. So I was surprised, actually, that many people thought that Nadal would win. To me, this two things struck me as this final went on and post this final. One is that Federer has just been liberated by the realization that his normal game will not beat Nadal, and he's got 10 years of evidence to prove that if he just played his normal game, it would not be enough against this guy just whipping these looping cross-court left-handed forehands into his backhand corner. And he has just liberated himself by saying, fine, I'm just going for it all the time, and you are not going to have a single chance to get into one of those rallies, because I am going to be teeing off like I'm playing against a kid, and if it goes in, great, if it doesn't, I don't care. And that, I think, has relaxed him. It's made him go in and think, you know, it's all on my racket. I used to say it, now I really mean it. Because if I connect, there's nothing you can do. And he's been connecting enough.
Yeah, it's interesting. Mark Petchy persistently made the point in commentary, both in the final and throughout the week, but particularly in the final in relation to Rafa, that even the unforced errors that Federer is making, to an extent, obviously it's not ideal, but to an extent, they benefited him, because as long as they're aggressive unforced errors, that's not giving Rafa any rhythm either. It's still not a rally for Rafa.
Yeah, so you can see the stress levels of Nadal rising in this match. It was a perfect microcosm of the problem that has been brought to him this year, that he can't find his rhythm against him, and he doesn't know where to stand to receive.
I also think Federer is liberated by feeling like he's got him. He's got him mentally at the moment. I think it was an incredibly smart strategic decision on reflection to not play that clay court season. I think he knows he can't beat him on clay, or is unlikely to beat him on clay. I wouldn't say he wouldn't have a chance. I think it would be closer perhaps now than a lot of their meetings on clay in the past, but mentally didn't want to risk damaging that mental hold he has over Nadal now. I also think what I heard at the time, and again, this is, you know, hearsay, I've not heard it from the mouth of Roger Federer or from Severin Luti or Ivan Ljubicic, but I can absolutely believe it, having watched that Shanghai match, is that Federer was relieved to have lost to Del Potro because he knew he wasn't in the shape to beat Nadal at the US Open, and he didn't want to sacrifice the mental hold he feels he has over Nadal. He would rather have lost to Del Potro than have gone one stage further and have lost to Nadal. We don't know if that would have happened, but he felt physically that he wasn't in the right shape to beat Nadal.
I know what you're saying. I personally don't necessarily buy it, because I don't think he looked that great during Shanghai either. And my view is, when he plays Nadal, it's a different match, different thing. It's now he feels like he's cracked it, and that he can just come out winging like that. I think, that liberating him has done an awful lot of good for him, because it means that he doesn't get drawn into these long matches with him anymore. He doesn't get ground down because there isn't time.
The head-to-head is now 23-15 in Nadal's favour. I don't see, as much as they keep surprising us and doing the unexpected, both of them, I don't see Federer overturning that. I think he'll end his career with a losing head-to-head over Nadal. However, he's won the last five, including the last four, which is all the matches since their mutual reincarnation. And I do think this changes the complexion of the sort of the greatest of all time debate, which we're not going to have, by the way. And I think most areas of that debate are redundant and annoying and sort of cyclical and frustrating. But I do think one of the more valid and interesting nuances to that debate always used to be the fact that how can you say somebody is the greatest tennis player of all time and they have a strong losing record against their greatest rival? I always found that a really interesting facet to the debate, and that is now, although he will end his career, I believe, with a losing record against Nadal, that's not such a strong argument anymore against Federer being the greatest. The fact that he has turned the tables so extraordinarily almost swings that nuance. It swings the pendulum in the other way.
You certainly can't use that as a stick to beat Federer with the way you could previously. The other thing that struck me watching that final was that it changes the way we look at their respective years, because I feel as though Nadal has spent a lot of this year in Federer's shadow. As wonderful as his year has been, he's won two Grand Slam titles. He's the world number one right now. He's going to most likely finish world number one. And yet, I feel as though most people think that Federer has had the better year. And I think
Interesting.
Yeah, I think if you asked most people, they would say, "Oh yeah, wasn't it amazing the way Federer came out of nowhere and won the Australian Open?" If I asked you, you would say, "I think we have talked more about how amazing Federer has been this year than how amazing Nadal has been this year." And more recently, I feel as though this last few weeks... Yeah, I would say so.
Okay.
This last few weeks, I think Nadal, with this run of 16 wins in a row, has redressed that balance to some degree. Obviously, he's won another slam, but then he started to streak away and he's underlined his dominance. But this final and the manner of the victory and the way it was exactly the same as Indian Wells and Miami, again, shakes you. It makes you think, well, hold on. Federer's absolutely thrashing him now. I mean, it's not even close. They look like they're on a different level when they're playing against each other. That's not to say, and it's quite interesting, I think that whether it was through Benito, Nadal's PR manager, or whether it was from his own mouth, I did read quotes that the year's not over yet. We're not done yet. And the desperation of... I know they were all pally and everything at the Laver Cup, but the desperation for Nadal to beat Federer now before the end of this year or at the Australian Open is going to be... He's going to be just drooling about the thought of that.
Well, he is still the world number one. He has a gap of 2,000 points, which sounds like an awful lot. However, Federer is scheduled to play Basel, Paris and London. There's a total of 3,000 points on offer at those three events. He can do it. He says it's not a priority for him to end the year as world number one. I think what we all dream of is a Federer-Nadal match at the O2 to decide the title and to decide the year-end number one. I don't think Federer is going to do it. I think Nadal is going to finish the year world number one. However, what you're saying there suggests to me it's more important to just get a win over Federer, maybe,
I think Nadal desperately wants to finish what he's been doing throughout the year. I think they'd both like to finish world number one. I think Nadal would probably savour it more. I think it matters more in the context of his year, because I just think Federer is just a different character, and he is playing to his own rules in a way, in his own mind.
Nadal's always talked about rankings more than Federer has. Maybe that's, you know, for a lot of the time Federer hasn't had to worry about rankings at all. But, you know, even in his dip years, he would always say, "Oh, but I'm six in the race and I'm going to qualify for London." And he would always have an eye on the rankings
it fits with his... He likes things to have a logical appearance to them, and having a calendar year and seeing where you end up at the end of the year makes sense to Nadal. I think what must be hard for him to swallow is he spent a career having this winning record against Federer, and then but Federer still kind of getting more of the headlines as being this all-time great. And now this year, Nadal has actually won more generally and more points, and yet Federer has won these matches in a row. And it, yet again, it ends up being a debate. But look,
well, the other thing is, extraordinarily, Nadal doesn't have a World Tour Finals title to his name.
And look, the other thing is, most of the, I think, in fact, all of the attempts that Nadal would have had to win that have been on a, maybe not a quick indoor surface, but an indoor surface, and it does favour Federer and Djokovic. It just does.
Oh, without question. I mean, Federer loves that court at the O2 almost as much as he loves the Wimbledon centre court. I'd say it's a close-run thing for him to sort of play a match for his life and to choose a court to play it on. I think it would be close run between those two courts. I really do. It suits him down to the ground, and I feel for Nadal in that
respect. What a difference 12 months makes. Think back 12 months ago. Andy Murray was trying to overhaul Novak Djokovic as world number one and ended up doing it in the last match of the year. And now we've had news come through this week that from Simon Briggs in the Telegraph that Murray's finally back on the practice court. And a year ago, we would have been saying the same, I guess, about Federer and Nadal. It is incredible the difference 1 year can make.
And no, we are not going to start making predictions about where we'll be 12 months from now.
You say that.
No, we're not. No, we are not. We have to talk about the knee, because I'm sure as they are listening to this, Nadal fans will be going, hang on, but he was having issues with the knee.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I think it wasn't only the final that he had the strapping on? I don't remember.
It was only the final he had the strapping on, absolutely. Yeah. And we'd been talking on the podcast, and I'd been talking about on my tennis radio commentary throughout the week, you know, how extraordinary it is that not only is Nadal doing what he's doing, but he's doing it without any strapping on his knees. And then, lo and behold, he rocks up with the strapping on. Was it his left knee or his right? I think his left knee. But I'm willing to be corrected on that. He said after the match, he confirmed it wasn't precautionary, but he didn't want to go into any more detail. He said after the final is not the time to talk about it. So admitting there's something, but then we know there's something. He has tendonitis, you know, in his knees, and that's not a curable condition.
And so how can it not surface at some point? The guy's in his 30s, he's played 9,000 matches. And the way he plays them, how can you not have tendonitis in your knees, or at least be at risk of it? The question mark is, how serious is it, whether he can keep ploughing his way through these tournaments to the end of the year and still have enough time off at the end of the year in order to recover for the new year. It's these players managing their bodies, it's a challenge at all times.
Yeah, I mean, more so for Nadal. I mean, if you look at Nadal's canister, the effort he puts into winning matches it just takes more from the canister than it does for Federer. It's just the nature of his game. I mean, yeah. Anyway, there are other talking points from Shanghai that sort of been somewhat eclipsed by the fact that we had the dream Federer-Nadal final, although in the end, not quite the dream Federer-Nadal final. My voice is being slightly eclipsed by the sound of coffee beans grinding in the background there.
Should we go and get one?
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, tennis podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right.
Right then, so other very important talking points from Shanghai last week. I've picked out a few. You're welcome to throw in a few more. I'm going to read them out and you can decide where to start, David. Del Potro, the performances, the wrist, the heartbreak, the amazing match against Federer. Dimitrov, just let that hang in the air. Dominic Thiem losing to Viktor Troitschkin in his first match.
I don't remember that.
And Nick Kyrgios retiring mid-match against Steve Johnson.
Yeah, well, first of all, Del Potro, just another great progression really in his comeback, and he seems to be starting to hit the backhand again finally after years of not being able to, pushing it and having to slice it. And then he took this fall. I didn't see it, but I heard he injured his wrist, and even after the match it was questionable whether he was going to be able to play that semi-final, and he did, and he made a heck of a job of it.
It was like watching Bambi, David. I mean, it was gut-wrenching, not in terms of plot lines,
exactly,
but in terms of the raw emotion that you feel watching him. And then you hear the news that he's gone straight to hospital, and just everything. It felt like the tennis world was collapsing.
It was a fall, was it?
It was a fall, yeah, onto his left wrist. He goes straight into hospital, and you're thinking, oh my goodness, What is the universe doing to Juan Martín Del Potro? Cut this guy a break. There's all this talk about, I mean, on the Sky Sports coverage of the build-up to the semi-finals, obviously the Nadal-Del Potro semi-final was second. I think they had Ross Hutchins on the coverage, and they were not quite assuming that Del Potro wouldn't play, but debating what would and should happen in this sort of scenario where one of the semi-finals doesn't get played, so effectively 50% of the matches that the crowd are promised don't happen. You know, should you bring in the losing quarter-finalist from the day before? You know, there was not quite an assumption that Del Potro wouldn't play, but very much this is highly likely.
What were they saying should happen?
Oh, it was... He wasn't saying anything should happen. He very strategically and politically ran through all the options,
a
lot of which
happen?
I've just listed. I think if the withdrawal takes place pre-match, I think there's a strong argument for bringing back the quarter-finalist from the day before.
Yeah, interesting one.
From the match before.
Yeah.
I mean, the issue you have is that, you know, they might have left.
Well, they better stick around then.
Yeah, I mean, I can't see many downsides or unintended consequences of that without having sort of analysed it fully, but I certainly think that would be worth a trial.
Agreed.
You're being very... your face is saying you've got more to say about that than...
No, I mean, the only thing I can think of is if they need to get to the next tournament for a particular match, but yeah.
Hey, you'd...
Keep them there.
You'd surely sacrifice a first round for a...
I remember being at the ATP finals in, I guess we're going back to about 2001, and Richard Krajicek was the alternate. And I remember him sticking around, watching all these matches, practicing, helping the other players. And then I remember seeing him in the restaurant as the final group match ticked on to start time, and he was looking at his watch, watching for them, and looking at the TV, looking at his flight reservation, and as soon as the first serve went in, he said, right, I'm off.
Wasn't enjoying his lovely holiday then?
No, he had a good time, but he wanted to go. I've had it now. I can't play now, so I'm bye. So,
what was the location of the, what city?
That would have been Hanover in Germany.
Is that a bad reflection on Hanover?
No, not really. And they did do probably the best food I've ever had at a tennis tournament. Oh, my
big
word.
Big words, David.
Yeah,
big
as well.
Words.
No, I'm telling you. Go and get in a time machine and sample it.
The Del Potro Federer match was unbelievable, wasn't it?
Having not seen it, I can't tell you that, but I assume it was, given the look on your face.
It was.
I was following it on Twitter, you know. I was actually at my kids. My daughter was playing her first ever tennis match professionally. I say professionally. Okay. Should I say competitively? Let's say competitively. And my son was playing football.
Oh,
and
dear. So, this is how pushy parenting starts.
Well, I'll tell you, I was there on the sideline. I was doing that thing on the sideline where you're just sort of shouting, and then if somebody does something to your kid, you're just sort of holding yourself back from getting on the pitch. Of course.
Did she win?
No. But, you know, it's a start, isn't it?
David.
Got to start somewhere. Sure, Federer didn't win his first... Well, anyway.
Right then. I don't know what to say. There was a game in the second set. In the second set, where Federer had 5 break points on the Del Potro serve. And I've never seen anybody play break points as well as Del Potro played those 5. And you just thought, goodness me, is this going to be one of those matches where he just, as much as it feels like Federer should surely break through at some stage, you know, he'd built so much momentum and so much pressure, is he just not going to, is Federer going to be unlucky? And of course he broke through on the sixth time of asking, and it was unbelievable. But, and I know Federer ended up winning, but it did, you know, it also emphasised for me how much the mental side of things is a factor, even for Federer, because Del Potro's in Federer's head, probably less so now that he got that win, eked out that win. But after the US Open, Del Potro was definitely in Federer's head. It was an irritated Federer in that match. He was having issues with all sorts of things. You know, he was unshaven, which added to the sort of angry Federer vibe that there was.
What did you think of the old unshaven Federer? I know sort of clothing and all that sort of thing isn't really your thing, but I did sit down to watch the final with my wife and kids, and my wife sat down and said, he hasn't shaved. What was the matter with him? It doesn't work, that, for her. You know?
Look, it's Roger Federer. He didn't look dreadful. Well, but I would opt for a clean-shaven Federer. Should we just touch upon Grigor Dimitrov very quickly?
It's the same as a week ago, really. He played a really good match against Nadal. At times he was playing
out of his
mind.
Should we run in a clip of what we said a week ago after Beijing?
I said two things about it. He's playing out of his mind, and he's just encapsulated his whole career in terms of potential by hitting 3 just ridiculous backhand winners to get to break point, and then he didn't break. You know,
yeah.
And then he encapsulated it by being the better player at times and not winning.
So, yeah, you know. Dave and I were exchanging texts during that match, and in particular during the final set, and David texted me saying Dimitrov's playing out of his mind, and I composed a reply which just said "and yet ... but I didn't send it, and at that stage that was when he was having the break points, when, you know, if it wasn't Grigor Dimitrov and you didn't know, you know, the history and everything, you'd think this guy is probably going to go on and win. How can he play this well and not win? But unfortunately I just had a feeling that he wasn't gonna, and he didn't. And I sent you that message after he had got broken, and I think when Nadal was serving for the match, and then I said, by the way, I've had that text composed for the last 15 minutes, and you said, oh, that's very arrogant and smug of you. And I, you know, I wanted to be wrong. Not necessarily that I wanted Nadal to lose at all. I just didn't want it to be a heartbreaking defeat from the jaws of victory for Grigor Dimitrov. And that's what it was.
Overall, though, I think he should be pretty encouraged, because he's playing well now, and because he knows pretty much he's going to be at the tour finals.
But that's, so
he's
that's
breaking
not,
new ground, isn't he?
We know Grigor Dimitrov can play well. Is that a breakthrough?
He's done
for
it
him?
Enough to get into the tour finals.
Yeah,
admittedly, he's been
big.
Helped along the way by about 4 notable people not being available to play.
I don't
at
think
all.
He's mathematically assured of it yet, but we're going to go into the various
races.
I think
he could be really good there if he got there. Anyway.
He could be really good anywhere, David.
No, but I think that would suit him. I do feel that tour finals, O2, big lights, round robin, not quite, you know, he can let it all flow.
And then he draws Nadal in the group stages, and the same thing happens again. Anyway, I hope I'm wrong. We have to touch upon Kyrgios before we move on to talk about the races. We won't dwell on it too much because it kind of feels like old news now. It happened last Tuesday, and I'm sure everyone's sort of read all sorts about what happened. He obviously, you know, having reached the final in Beijing, very understandably, could have been mentally and physically drained. He arrived in Beijing on the Sunday. No, he arrived in Shanghai on the Monday, played doubles that evening, won the doubles, then played his first singles match on the Tuesday against Steve Johnson. And it was a good first set, a tetchy first set from Kyrgios. Very much serve dominated. It went into a tiebreak. And there was a call in the tiebreak, which Kyrgios was unhappy about. Anyway, what ended up happening was, reportedly Kyrgios was heard muttering under his breath, "If I lose this tiebreak, I'm going to throw in the towel." He ended up losing the tiebreak, and without having made clear that there was any kind of injury or having called the trainer or even explaining to the umpire or Steve Johnson, he approached the net and threw in the towel and didn't do press after the match. So everyone was left wondering a little bit what on earth was going on. He later released a statement saying he had a stomach bug, and that was what caused him to retire from the match. But it's fair to say he came in for a fair amount of stick for it. I'll let you have your say. We debated it at length on WhatsApp this week. My feeling is it wasn't okay. It wasn't cool what he did. I commentated the match, and I know that not giving 100% effort does happen. I think he was giving 100% effort in that first set, and I think being knackered from Beijing, and you know, I've no idea if he genuinely did have a stomach bug. We've got no reason not to take that at face value, but it didn't look good at the time. I don't know why he couldn't have explained to Steve Johnson quickly, "Mate, I've got a stomach bug," even to the umpire. You know, there's a whole crowd there that were really into that match. I think that's a bit disrespectful. I don't know why it took him so long to release the statement. Look, I don't think we should come down on him like a ton of bricks. I do believe that there is more spotlight on what he does and how he behaves, and there are others that have done and do this kind of thing, and we perhaps don't talk about it as much, if at all. But then he invites a lot of attention as well. You know, the day before, he released this big article on the Player's Voice about how he's found his purpose, his raison d'etre in tennis, and it's to build a centre for disadvantaged kids, which is a wonderful thing. I read that and I felt uplifted and joyous, and not only has Nick Kyrgios found a reason to give full effort on the tennis court, but you know, it's for this wonderful cause, and that's fantastic. And then, but you know, there is the dichotomy that is Nick Kyrgios.
Yeah, look, it didn't look great. I would agree with you 100%. In an ideal world, Nick Kyrgios would be all those wonderful things that we know he is capable of being all the time. And he would be able to go from week to week just trotting this out as a matter of course without any dramas whatsoever, doing all the wonderful stroke play and fulfilling his enormous potential skill set-wise. But he's a human being who isn't made exactly the same as everybody else. And we're all different. And I feel as though if you go back a year, it's basically the same as what happened in Shanghai. It slightly manifested itself a little bit differently, but the week before he tapped out against Misha Zverev a year ago in Shanghai, he was incredible in winning the title, I think, in Tokyo that time.
It was
one of the most uplifting performances I've seen all year. So exciting. The same thing happened against Alexander Zverev the week before in Beijing. I think this guy hits the wall and can't hack it anymore.
But I personally, I'm sure others would have been up in arms, because I do think there is a culture of people enjoying being up in arms about things that Nick Kyrgios does. And you know, yeah, I do believe that's the case. I would have been fine with him pulling out of that match and citing mental exhaustion, physical exhaustion. I'm fine with that. I get it. I've got no problem with him not being a robot. Sure. I have an awful lot of sympathy for
that. Do you always know when you've got mental exhaustion until it hits you? Always?
No, but I think to
maybe he was trying to do the right thing and play the match.
First things first, David, he didn't give that as the reason for retiring from that
match.
No,
because that's not acceptable to people, is it? Telling people you've got a stomach bug is... Writing
down
a little statement.
Yeah, but David, you're making huge assumptions. It will never be acceptable until... I think that's acceptable. I think that's
sure,
more
sure
than
do,
acceptable.
But listen to the reaction when he tapped out of the match and walked off the court. Everybody's like saying,
David.
There's nothing wrong with him. Look at him.
Hang on,
he's
David.
Fine. Why isn't
but
he playing?
But did you watch the match?
No, I didn't.
I think if you're overheard saying, if I lose this set, I'm going to retire, that's not good, is it?
No, maybe
it's
you
a mental exhaustion that only applies.
Maybe
if
he's realizing at that stage he's had enough and he just can't handle it anymore. I'm not saying it's great.
It's not great. How he handled it is not great.
There
I would have
so
had no
people,
problem with him retiring
said, at the outset. Yeah, I still say you can't always know. You might go onto the court with an injury and say, I'm going to give it a go.
Fine, well, but he's not said that.
Why didn't you?
He's not
out
said that, David. You're making non-evidence based assumptions.
Sure, in the absence of evidence, I'm giving you
but
a
there
possibility.
Is evidence. The evidence we have is what we saw and what he said. And on the basis of that,
I'm
it's
saying
not great.
What he said is the acceptable side of things, because it is acceptable for people to have a physical injury in everybody's eyes and not play the rest of the
you
match.
You think it's acceptable to Steve Johnson to say, if I lose a set, I'm going to retire, and then just to
it's
walk
not,
off the court
not
and
great,
not explain to him
but I also
or the
saw,
crowd.
Over the last few weeks, I saw Coco Vandeweghe leave with an injury. I saw Sloane Stephens lose her four sets since the US Open title, 6-2, 6-2, 6 love, 6-3, 6 love.
Yeah,
and she just walked off, and nobody batted an eyelid.
I'd say
people
that's
do it with injuries
valid,
all the time.
It's
they're
a
going,
valid point.
People go into slams all the time, injured, and it would be much better if they just didn't play the match and let somebody else take their place. But oh no, they go on, get three games under the belt, and then leave.
I'd say that's a very valid point. Very valid point. And well, maybe it's all of our faults.
Look,
for
maybe the guy's got a terrible attitude problem, right? That may be what the truth is. I'm just telling you that there is a possibility that it is not just that.
I think everyone's aware there's a possibility.
And I'm giving you that those circumstances.
And I think if it is
so
that I'm very sympathetic with it. But there are ways that you have to handle things. And even if it was that, he didn't handle it well at all. And it looked bad for
the
sport.
I don't deny that.
But anyway, yeah, I don't believe that we should come down on him like an absolute ton of bricks. I just think I commentated it and it looked bad, and it's just gutting because, yeah, that article the day before and the performance the week before, and he's just so great and fundamentally, really, for me, I know not everyone agrees, really likeable and anyway. David's giving me that look.
We don't have all the answers,
just as
do we?
I keep saying that I will just give an update on the various races. The situation with the race to Singapore is that it is over. We have our eight players for Singapore, and Caroline Garcia is one of those eight players. She has qualified without having had to play in Hong Kong this week. She pulled out of Hong Kong. She, of course, wasn't awarded a wildcard for Moscow, but no matter, because Jo Konta has withdrawn from the Kremlin Cup in Moscow. She said today that she will make a decision in the next few days as to whether she feels fit enough to travel to Singapore as an alternate. We can make Kyrgios-based assumptions about Kyrgios-esque assumptions about what's going on with Jo Konta mentally. My feeling is that I think what happened last year in Singapore affected her more than I realised at the time, because she dealt with it so well. Her rocking up there, being in all the draw photos and being a part of it all, and then Svetlana Kuznetsova knocking her out of position at the very last second, and her having to sort of sit there magnanimously on the sidelines. I think there is a foot injury, don't get me wrong. I'm not questioning that she's lying about that, but I also think there's something sort of psychological and emotional going on, which is very understandable.
I can imagine that being probably more, though, to do with her form of late and how much it is capitulated.
But then it's chicken and egg, isn't it? What what caused I think it's both. The psychological pressures have contributed to the lack of form, and the lack of form have contributed to the psychological pressures.
Yeah, for sure.
But as we've discussed a lot over the last couple of weeks, Caroline Garcia in extraordinary form, finally coming good on all that
it
talent, and a very deserving...
To come from where she did and win those two particular titles, to I mean, if ever you were going to take somebody's place, that's the way to do it.
Yeah, and it's hard to argue that she's not deserving. Quick update on the race to London, in which there are very much places up for grabs. Pablo Carreño Busta, currently in eighth position. He has 2,605 points, but it's fair to say that those players in the tussle for the last couple of positions, generally speaking, did not have a good week last week. John Isner kind of did the best of them, but I commentated a couple of his matches, including his loss to Viktor Troicki, and he looked dead on his feet. I question what he has left to give in the rest of the season, although let's remember he played brilliantly in Paris last year, so we'll see. Sam Querrey had a bad week. Kevin Anderson had a bad week. Pablo Carreño Busta lost to Albert Ramos Vinola, so they're all kind of falling by the wayside a bit, apart from Juan Martín Del Potro, who's up to 18th, has 1,885 points. If the wrist weren't a factor and he were able to play Stockholm and Paris, I would think he's in with a good shout. But, of course, there are physical concerns, which we've covered. So there you go. But it's exciting. I think the race for those final couple of positions is going to be exciting. We asked for listener questions, and I think it would be a bit rude now to completely ignore them. I know we're very, very tight for time, so I'm going to read them out, and we're going to cover them extremely... I've picked three of the best ones. We're going to cover them extremely quickly. If we haven't picked yours, but there were three better ones, frankly.
a diplomat.
First one. Well, in my view, anyway. First one from Susie, ATP Player of the Year. Is it Federer Nadal? I know we've covered that a little bit. In fact, we've kind of covered it completely, haven't we?
Is one of those the...
I mean,
ATP,
well, you've covered
it
completely. My feeling is I think it's neck and neck at the moment.
Yeah, it is. And that's why we have end-of-year Player of the Year awards here on the Tennis Podcast.
So, do we?
Yeah, we do. So wait. Don't you remember the Alan Mills episode from 2 years ago?
Yeah, I mean...
Come on,
but
that was a belter.
I just thought we could never top that.
Well,
so
we're doing it again. So
it's going to be a one-off. Yeah. But yes, okay, Susie, we will defer that question to the end of the year. So that... deals with that one quickly. Greg asks, what are our thoughts on Stefanos Tsitsipas?
Who
got his first ever tour level win last week, having qualified for the seventh time for a tournament for the year. He's a former junior world number one. He's Greek. He took over from Denis Shapovalov as junior world number one. He's just transitioning to the seniors, not the seniors tour, that would be a bit of a leap, to the main tour. David is looking at me completely blankly, so we might move on from this question quite quickly as well.
I think we might.
This is why we don't do listening questions very often.
Especially
people.
Not letting me know first.
I think he is very talented, but completely unproven at the moment in terms of senior level. He's been plugging away on the Challenger Tour. He's been plugging away with qualifying. I like his attitude, but he's not really been tested against the top level yet. And so until I see that, I don't know.
That's the thing. But it's always exciting to see somebody make dramatic moves early on in their career on the Challenger circuit, etc. I always like to look out for those guys and then see how they transition.
Yeah, so wait and see, Greg, is our very decisive answer to that one. And then we have Will Slater asking, would Andy Murray's fitness be best served by skipping his exhibition event, his Andy Murray Live, which is to benefit charity? I think bottom line, there's absolutely no way he's going to miss it, and that is to his great credit, because he's just not the sort of guy that would, you know, I think he'd play it on one leg, frankly.
I think if anything, it'll just help him sample a match court with a crowd again and run about fast and hit the ball. The only problem is the bloke down the other end is Roger Federer, so that's slightly tricky.
I think bottom line is we don't know, because we don't know where Andy Murray is physically. He's not been hitting tennis balls for that long. He's been doing a lot of rehab and working the gym and Pilates and that sort of stuff. He's only started hitting in the last week or so we don't know. But we do also know about exhibition tennis that I'm not saying it won't be a great match and it won't be competitive, and I'm, you know, they're not going to go out there and dolly the ball, but there is something in the back of their minds when it's an exhibition match that...
Nobody's going to be trying to humiliate anybody.
Nobody's going to be falling over and risking injury or, you know, in terms of that sort of exertion, I think he's in the clear. You know, it's not going to do him any damage.
It's unlikely to do him any damage, is what I'd say. Unless he was unlucky.
And, you know, you could be unlucky. You know, I fell over trying to put my socks on this morning.
Have you got any video of that?
I've not. So unless he's highly unlucky, I don't think he will be damaging his prospects of a return. And Craig Tiley seems very confident that he'll be playing the Australian Open.
I wish I could have... I have got Craig Tiley's outlook. What am I talking about? And I haven't even got a tournament to promote. So
yeah, Craig Tiley learned it all from you, David.
Excellent.
Yeah, we're on for that Borg-McEnroe final at the Australian Open. We can't wait. We have been the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph and with Eurosport, brought to you from the Putney Exchange and a coffee shop which we don't name because we haven't received any free coffee. See you next week.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.